FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. And well, you know, we've been working with mining companies for nearly a decade now, and some stand out and some really stand out. We've got a lineup of sponsors now that is truly impressive. Perhaps among the most impressive is Lumina Gold. You're probably familiar with the Lumina Group. That's the Ross Beattie-led enterprise that on $190 million invested, it's returned so far over $1.6 billion to investors and is still going strong. It's not done yet. Ross Beattie, legendary resource investor. He has done things that nobody believed possible. And now off of the Lumina Group comes Lumina Gold. You can find him on the TSX Venture under the ticker symbol LUM, or on the OTC, you'll find them at LMGDF. And well, with me is a good friend of the show, Marshall Koval. Marshall, safe to say, when it comes to mining, you've been doing it for 42 years. You've probably forgotten more than most people know, and you've worked on such a diverse range of projects in over 30 countries. You've been a CEO, you're CEO of director of Luminex Resources, as well as Lumina Gold. Oh, and I should mention that you can go over to luminagold.com, see the company's presentation, all of the important information. It's all on the site there. Really good site, very great depth there. So Marshall, this isn't your first rodeo. You're the CEO of the company and close associate of Ross Beattie. What is it about this project that has really got your juices flowing?
Yeah, I've been associated with Ross since 2014 for all the Lumina Group stories that you mentioned earlier. But what really gets me on Cangrejos is the 38th largest primary gold asset in the world. This is based on the resource estimate that we put out a few months back, roughly 17 million ounces of gold and about 2.2 billion pounds of copper. So when I say the 38th largest primary gold asset, that includes mines, development stories, exploration projects. So the thing's massive. And it's in an emerging jurisdiction in Ecuador. And Cangrejos, we've done a lot of work to start to understand the scale of the deposit. We've grown the deposit from the Cangrejos deposit itself to adding the Gran Bestia deposit. So now we have a project that we're doing a PEA on, updating the 2018 PEA to include the Gran Bestia deposit. So this thing is world-class scale, and we're really excited with the project.
And clearly, it's a tier one level project, and the amount of gold that's there. You know, many of you investors out there, I know you say, but it's in Ecuador. But the story of Ecuador, and we'll get into the benefits of the project, to the infrastructure, et cetera. But Marshall, the Ecuador story is one that has dramatically evolved over the past 6 years. It used to be Ecuador, you just think Ecuador equals expropriation, and you just don't do it there. But we're in a whole new world there, largely, if I'm not mistaken, due to their decline in oil exports. They need other sources of revenue to keep the country going.
Yeah, 100%. So if you look at sort of the history of Ecuador, and before I go into the history, let me just frame it as it's really the last systematically explored jurisdiction in certainly Latin America and probably the world. It's got the same geology coming through the Andes that Peru and Chile have. It's really prone to large-scale copper deposits and gold projects as well. And it's emerging, becoming a destination. You know, you've got BHP, Anglo American, Newcrest, Fortescue, Codelco, Dundee, Southern Copper. All these guys are in the country now. And a lot of that has to do with the improvement in the fiscal regime, like you mentioned, Kerry, in the last 6 years, where the government was dependent on oil price for their budget. They had budgeted sort of $100 a barrel oil. that went south. The country basically got into deep economic debt, and they realized that the mining sector, which had basically been shut down since 2008 when they quit allowing new concessions, so they really missed out on this whole last super cycle. And now after we've gone down in the cycle and we're starting to move back up in the gold cycle in particular, the country's sort of done some fiscal reforms. They got rid of windfall profit tax. They started to give VAT back after the projects go into production. They lowered their royalty rate from 5 to 8% range down to 3 to 8% range. And then in the meantime, since sort of 2014, when they started to try to attract mining foreign investment into the country, a couple significant projects have gone into production. You know, the first one being Mirador, which is a plus $1 billion investment in a copper porphyry deposit that is owned by AXA. Tongling Mining is one of the parents of AXA. And that's in production. That's a 60,000 ton per day project that just went into production at the end of December. And then Fruta del Norte, Lundin Gold's project that's in production now, that's a high-grade underground project. So this whole thing has happened, and you've gone from being a country that didn't really want mining, at least in the political level, to a country that now has two major mines in project in progress. And as Mirador and Fruta del Norte go, we anticipate that the mining investment climate will continue to improve in Ecuador.
Yeah, no doubt you're right. And you see, when all the big players are gravitating there, and when you combine that with your relationship with the community, they're favorably disposed towards the project. And then you look at all the infrastructure that's right there, literally at your doorstep. This kind of makes this project a no-brainer. Your CapEx is very controllable. And, right, I mean, you look at the power, the water, road, everything you need, including a seaport that's 40, between, there's two seaports, one 30 kilometers away and one 40. This makes it ideal.
Yeah, I think those sort of things that you just mentioned really help, particularly what you got to think of Cangrejo scale-wise. It's not a typical gold project. You got to think of it as a scale of a porphyry copper project. So in the PEA that we did in 2018, the initial production throughput would be 40,000 tons per day. So the Mirador mine, which is a major copper mine that just went into production, the plant was built to 60,000 tons per day, and they're ramping up towards that now. And then in year six, we would start production at 80,000 tons per day. So think of this as a scale of a big copper project. And it is a lower grade. It's not the kind of grades of Fruta del Norte, but all the infrastructure things that you talk about, it's got a low stripping ratio, like 1 to 1, 1 ton of waste to 1 ton of ore. It's got power in the country. Ecuador has cheap power. They've got an interconnected grid. A lot of the power is hydropower. You mentioned the Puerto Bolivar is about 40 kilometers away. That's where we would look to ship concentrates. There's paved roads within 8 kilometers of the project. There's ample water, and it's a lower elevation compared to a lot of these large Andean projects. You know, I was CEO of Northern Peru Copper, and we had the Galeno project near Yanacocha in Peru, and you had to ship concentrates 350 kilometers to get them to a port. So we're near a port, and as you mentioned, the communities are supportive of the project. And obviously, as the project continues to develop, the CSR work that we do, the community social responsibility work, will continue to be a primary focus going forward. So all those sort of things kind of bode well for the project. And we've been doing the engineering work at a lot of the projects to pre-feasibility study to de-risk the project. So, you know, things are advancing quite well. We'll have an updated PEA out by the end of the second quarter this year. And that new PEA will include the Gran Bestia deposit in Cangrejo. So, you know, a lot of positive things related to this project.
And right now, it's all 100% you. Do you foresee taking in a joint venture partner on this project?
Listen, we've been pretty much focused on defining and understanding the project. And, you know, obviously we're an exploration development company. And if you look at the business model, it's the same business model as Lumina Copper, where we would get these projects, add value, do the exploration, de-risk them, and move them on to a company that would ultimately produce them, produce the project or construct the project. So one of the good examples of that is one of our first endeavors was the Regalito mine in Chile, which is today the Caserones mine. Now, that project was taken over by Pan Pacific at the stage where we hadn't completed a PEA economic study, but we had done a fair amount of engineering work. So this project, Cangrejos, you know, we've done a lot of engineering work, and it's at the stage where somebody could come in, pick up the work we've done. They would do their own pre-feasibility study, more than likely, or feasibility study, and advance the project. And we're getting to the stage now where we understand the scope and the size of the project. And now we started to, we've had some inbound interest, and we're starting to look at, you know, the Lumina Copper business model. When do we look for an exit?
Right. And also what you've got with these major gold producers and worldwide, you've got for the past few years declining gold production. And as a result, they're looking to replace reserves. And this presents a real opportunity for expansion of reserves and replacement of reserves, right?
Yeah, that's a huge deal. I mean, as you get larger and larger and you get companies that produce 3, 4, or 5 million ounces a year, it's a real issue to get reserve replacement. So I think that's a good segue to talk a little bit about, you know, I was talking about the macro numbers on Cangrejos as far as the resource goes. But let me give you an idea here. We have 10.4 million ounces of gold in the indicated category and 6.3 in the inferred. And we have 1.4 billion pounds of copper in the indicated category and 0.8 in the inferred. So if you were to move this to a pre-feasibility study today, you would be able, and that was successful, you would be able to report the resource of 10.4 ounces in whatever mining deductions you took. And that would be a probable reserve after a pre-feasibility study was completed. So from a reserve replacement perspective, we've done enough of infill drilling to prove up that there's a large number of ounces in the indicated drilling category that would support a pre-feasibility study. And ultimately, after a pre-feasibility study was complete, you'd be able to report a reserve of some sort on the project.
Right. And therefore, making it a prime candidate for one of the majors to both replenish their reserves and up their production. And all of that works in your favor. So, Marshall, talking about you, 42 years of experience, you've been developing mines literally all over the world. What is the biggest lesson you've learned from all of these different countries, governments, different concerns? What is it that you would say really is the biggest lesson?
First of all, listening to you, I learned that I'm old, but I started in the industry when I was 21. And I think credibility is a key issue. I think both at a shareholder level, at a government level, with your employees, with your communities, I think communication is a real key thing. And sometimes that's a hard thing to do to all the different stakeholders that you have. But I think if you take the shareholder scenario, first of all, you got to be able to lay the story out. You can't blow too much smoke up here. Obviously, we all think we have good projects and we want to promote them going forward. But you also have to be credible to be able to back up what you put out there. So if you go to our website and you look at our corporate presentations, you know, there's 20, 30 people involved and sometimes more behind all the engineering work that we do and all the geology work. And that has to be credible, first of all. And that has to be credible when you talk to governments. That has to be credible when you talk to communities, obviously shareholders, as I mentioned. But also, you have to communicate that to your employees so that they understand that integrity to be transparent and communicate specifics without a lot of smoke and mirrors is really what is critical. And I think what you also have to do is you have to be a pretty damn good listener. You know, governments have their issues, what they want to see, what they would like out of investors. In the case of Ecuador, they need foreign investment. And so you need to deal with the governments in a respectful and straightforward manner. The communities are the same way. I mean, you get into a lot of these developing countries where you're dealing with communities that are primarily subsistence agriculture and stuff. And you know what? You got to respect those people as much as shareholders or government officials or anybody. So those are real lessons that I've kind of learned. And I think I grew up in Brazil when I was in sort of seventh and eighth grade. And what you really have to do there is learn to listen and respect these people and treat them fairly. And that goes all the way from the poorest farmer up to the top government official and obviously all your shareholders. So that's one of the key lessons that I've learned.
Yeah. And I think that's very important. This isn't the same world as it was 40 years ago when you started out. Things like reclamation, remediation plans, and what to do, the best practices in the industry, right?
Yeah.
Best practices.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, for instance, on our engineering work that we're doing, we're looking at mine closure scenarios, and we haven't even built a mine yet. So that's become common practice. And you look at it from environmental perspective, you look at it from a social perspective, you look at all those things. And, you know, that's been a real change in the industry over the years. And, you know, through the years of experience that I had, I was a consultant for quite a while. I was president of Pinnock, Allen & Holt, a really well-regarded international consulting firm, both in mining finance, support of banks, and then also a lot of environmental work. So I've not only been an explorationist, developed projects, been involved in construction, but I've also been involved in closing mines. You know, most notably was Azumarra's Cannon Mine in Washington State, and had to deal with the regulators and the communities and interested parties there. So the earlier you can plan the end game for the project, the better project you're going to develop as you engineer it.
Yeah. And that, you know, looking ahead. So when people still have this notion in their minds, though, from the 70s and 80s of polluted rivers and streams and piles of debris just left there or who knows what. And it's really so much different than that now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, most of that legacy leftover was turn of the century to mid-century, say, in the North American context. But technologies have changed so much. For instance, at Cangrejos, we're looking at dry stack tailings facilities instead of tailings dams and with water retention behind them. So basically, you have a large filtration plant. You dry the tailings to about a 15% moisture, and you recycle about 85% of the water back through the process plant. And, you know, that isn't the only way to do a tailings project. That just happened to be best suited for the Cangrejos project. But you could have used a conventional tailings project with, you know, modern management technology and modern design, and you can have those safe as well. So, you know, all those points in planning, you know, become critical to projects. You know, the other thing too is Cangrejos, what you look for there is trying to minimize water usage the best you can. You know, the tailings fit into that. Collecting rainwater in the pit. You have some inflows of water into the pit and using that. So those sort of things are key. And then, you know, treatment technologies for cyanide destruction and different reagents and management practices, that's all evolved considerable. And, you know, we use specialist environmental process geotechnical consultants to help us, make the best designs we can in these areas.
Yeah. So it all fits in together. Hey, what is the one thing that you're most excited about that keeps you going, really keeps you up at night and keeps you wanting to stay in mining when you look at this?
Yeah, I think I think staying in mining, I don't know anything different. It's in my blood. I think if you talk to most guys that have been in the industry a long time, the excitement, the complexity of the projects, the ability to solve problems and then take a project from an exploration stage all the way to ultimately being built and constructed. I think that's the real exciting part about this. And it's really complex problems that you have to solve because you have government, you have technical, you have financial, you have environmental, community considerations that you have to put into those equations. So that kind of thing is really exciting to a guy like me. Ross is the same way. Ross is pretty much at the forefront of the entrepreneurial aspect of combining everything I just talked about and becoming successful and, you know, ultimately producing mines. For instance, he's done that in Pan American Silver. He's doing that in Equinox Gold right now. And, you know, that's kind of the mindset that you have to be able to take on those challenges and have a clear vision of where you want to go. And, you know, stepping back to Cangrejos and Lumina Gold, our vision is to discover, which we've done with Gran Bastia and Cangrejos, add value that way, de-risk the project, engineering, environmentally, all those things, and then move it on to ultimately be built. So things that keep me up at night, anytime you have a group of an organization, you have people and people have issues. Everybody's got their own problems, good and bad. Oh, yeah. I would say those issues, caring about the people we have and trying to put them into positions of success. And then when that doesn't happen, you know, that then you got to make tough decisions. Those are the kind of things that are always hard to do. And, you know, you always stress over those. If you have to let an employee go or that sort of thing, those are the things that bother me. But the day-to-day interaction with the government, with the communities, with the employees, with our engineering and exploration team, that stuff doesn't keep me up at night. The markets do a little bit. You know, in our case, we have the whole Ecuadorian development group is trading at about 0.27 PNAV, whereas other Western developers are trading at about 0.56. And this goes back to what you were talking about, having about $7, $8 per ounce of gold in situ value for the company. That bothers me a lot because I think we're at the stage in the market where the junior development space hasn't really caught up with the major and the mid-tier producers yet. And then we have a bit of an Ecuador discount, primarily because of the history, and that's all changing. But, you know, those are the things that I think from a shareholder, it provides an opportunity right now because I think our valuation is significantly lower than it should be. But, you know, as somebody running a company, that grates on you, right? And yeah, of course. You do the best you can to communicate and show results to the market. And like I was talking about earlier, Cangrejos is, you know, a world-class resource, and we're not seeing the value for it. So I guess that would be my biggest frustration.
Understandably so. Totally get it. And if I could just sum up the skills that are required of a modern mining exploration company CEO, it's kind of like you're one part mining engineer, one part geologist, because even though you're not looking at the rocks per se, you still got to understand it. You're one part diplomat, you're one part therapist, and one part, basically messenger back and forth to the project to all the interested parties. So that's like, they never taught you that in mining school, did they?
No. And you pick that up along the way. You know, that's when you get to the point of somebody like Ross or myself, where you have that many years of experience. You kind of learn those different things as you go. And the successful CEOs have the aptitude to be able to do that. And not only the CEOs, the upper level management in these companies. And there's one more thing you gotta throw in there as well is, you know, we operate in Ecuador. So language is another significant deal. So, you know, fortunately, I'm at the point where I'm fluent enough in Spanish that I can go in with the government, communities, vendors, anybody within the country and deal with them in their own language. So that aspect of it is important, too. And I remember being in university when they said I had to take a language class. And I said, why the hell do I need that? But, you know, that's another really important thing. And Spanish is, you know, after English, I believe it's second largest spoken language. Put Mandarin Chinese to the side, but in more countries in the world, they speak Spanish. So those two languages, if you have that as a CEO or upper level management, is pretty key these days in the mining sector.
Yeah. So it's pretty remarkable that the things you actually train to do are probably some of the things you do the least, but you wouldn't have been able to do them if you hadn't started at the bottom and worked your way up and done all of these different mines all over the world. And being a linguist definitely is a real plus when you're working in Latin America, where you don't have to expect them to understand English, or you don't have to have a translator present, so stuff gets lost in translation. So yeah. A lot of different skill sets come into play to be the modern mining exploration CEO. And it seems like you've got virtually all of them in place. It always does come down to the people when you get down to it. Hey, we really appreciate you coming on, Marshall. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the website, which is luminagold.com. The ticker symbol on the TSX, ticker symbol on the TSX Venture, which is LUM, and on the OTC, we're looking at LMGDF. Marshall, wish you the best of luck. Any questions or comments for Marshall or myself, I'd love to hear from you. Just send us an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. Marshall, good luck. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Thanks, Kerry.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.